I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American soldiers have been conducting secret reconnaissance missions inside Iran, and the missions have been underway for several months in preparation for potential U.S. military strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. This, according to Seymour Hersh, writing in the latest New Yorker magazine. Hersh reports that the operations have been authorized by President Bush with little or no congressional oversight. Well, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh joins us now on the line from Washington, D.C. And, Cy, we've heard reports that the U.S. was considering these kinds of covert military operations, but you say they're already underway.
What I write in the magazine this week is simply that since July, we've been aggressively pursuing in trying to collect intelligence about Iran, its potential nuclear, chemical, and missile facilities, with the goal being to spread democracy and as we put it, into the Middle East, and the goal being to strike at certain targets inside Iran with the hope that it will trigger perhaps some sort of secular dissent among the population there and get rid of the mullahs.
But are military operations, secret military operations, already underway in the country?
There's been reconnaissance, yes, from Afghanistan. Also, we have various assets coming in from Iraq, crossing the border into Iran. And also, there's other intelligence. The Israelis are in Kurdistan, and they're doing intelligence collection from Kurdistan.
Well, covert CIA operations have to be reported to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, but you write that these operations are not CIA, as we said, they're military. Does this represent a major shift?
Well, Rumsfeld's won a big battle. Rumsfeld, for 2 years or 2.5 years, has been in a struggle with the CIA. He thinks the military can do things better than the CIA. He says he doesn't think the CIA gets it. And so it's been one of his big ambitions, which is to take over intelligence collection. And the argument being this, that as it works now, if the CIA does an operation that has to be reported, not only does the president have to formally make a finding about it and tell Congress about it, it also has to be briefed. And the way the Pentagon sees it is a military operation, even though it may do the same thing the CIA was doing, that is an undercover, covert operation. If it's done by the military, it's an act of war that can be authorized directly by the president, and you don't have to go through Congress.
Well, the administration, along with European countries, doesn't want Iran to develop nuclear weapons. That's no secret. Even the Clinton administration seriously considered military strikes on Iran at one time.
I'm not sure of that. Is that true?
It's in Richard Clark's book. He reported on it pretty extensively, or spoke about it pretty extensively after his book came out. So I guess the question is, does this come as a surprise that these covert operations are underway?
One thing about this administration is they pretty much do what they say they're going to do, and they've been talking, the president just last weekend in an interview with the Washington Post, talked again about how the people in Iran really want to do something. They want to be free, and they want to get rid of the mullahs, and they're waiting for America. So no, if you look at it, you know, well, I think what's important about the stuff I'm finding is that the neoconservatives in this administration consider Iraq and Syria and the global war on terrorism as separate war zones, separate from Iraq. So what happens in Iraq doesn't spill over. The disaster in Iraq doesn't necessarily stop them from planning to do other actions. And for a lot of people, frankly, the people that talk to me, they really seem to think that we're sort of in a position that's analogous to our position before the Iraqi war, when we had the UN trying to do something with peacekeepers and Bush didn't wait. And right now we have the European Union, the EU, trying to do something in direct negotiations with Iran, and Bush may once again not wait.
What do you think is the likelihood of military operations against Iran in, as you say, a few months or by the summer?
I think that the people who are talking to me decided to talk to me because they're very worried about this staying on track, and I think they think that a story now raising questions about it would get Congress mobilized, the public mobilized, and make it harder for the Bush administration to do something in Iran. It would at least force the Bush administration to pay more attention to what the Europeans are doing and maybe support the European negotiations. Right now, the Europeans feel they're in a lose-lose position with us. Mm-hmm. We don't help them in the talks, and we're just sitting and watching.
Well, you say operations such as the ones we've been talking about in Iran have also been authorized in as many as 10 other countries. What are the implications of these operations for the special forces?
Well, the difference here with the other countries, they're different than Iran. Iran's pointed at getting intelligence on the nuclear facility. Rumsfeld also has won another battle that I write about, that he's been given basically a carte blanche to operate with armed forces and not the CIA in undercover activities in a number of countries, many of them in North Africa, where there's, we think, growing terrorism. And so there's nothing wrong, by the way, in a perfect world. Of course you'd want America, have the American government being aggressive. But in this case, Rumsfeld's going to be operating without the CIA and without telling, without having any obligation, as he sees the law, to tell Congress, to tell the American ambassadors in various countries, to tell even the military commanders in various countries what his people are doing. They're going to go in, wipe clean, as I say, with Americans with different life, you know, different passports and different cover stories, and trying to set up operations to go after international terrorists. And the one way you find out about international terrorism is you do rough stuff yourself. As somebody said, we're going to be riding with the bad boys. And again, the issue there is not that we're doing that. It's that Rumsfeld is taking control and doing it without clearing it with the CIA. That's a whole new departure. It's Rumsfeld's one, CIA nothing right now.
Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. His latest report appears in the New Yorker magazine. Seymour, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, will Iran or North Korea, two-thirds of the axis of evil, be mentioned in President Bush's second inaugural address this Thursday afternoon? Will he concentrate more on security, the wars on terrorism and in Iraq, or Social Security? We'll address what the president is likely to address in a moment. But first, what will the Bush inauguration, only the 16th seconds wearing in the country's history, look like? Republicans are preparing for parties, parades, pomp, and politics in the nation's capital. That's the sound of players rehearsing for Thursday's inaugural parade, just one of the many events taking place during the four-day celebration in Washington that will cost between $35 and $40 million and has already sparked protests such as Turn Your Back on Bush and Not One Damn Dime. That's a consumer strike. Well, security will be tight, and President Bush is warning that the ceremony could make Washington an attractive target for terrorists. Joining us on the line for an inauguration preview, John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hello, John.
Hey, Robin.
We also welcome back Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Robin.
And John, to you first, a criticism of the cost of this inauguration in the wake of the tsunami and while a war is in progress. Your thoughts?
You know, I think it's a legitimate question to raise. The Bush family and Democrats, frankly, Bill Clinton, have said, look, this is something that happens every 4 years. It's a celebration for the country. It, of course, is an extra celebration for Republicans who supported Bush, and that's principally who it's for in a narrow sense. But the amount of money that is going to this, they're raising $40 million to put on the inaugural events. I think that it's fair to raise the question about tone. They're trying to respond by emphasizing the sacrifice of U.S. soldiers, but it's hard to deny the need for some sort of event to mark the event. To mark the second term. So I think it's a little bit of carping from the critics to focus on this.
Well, but you also mentioned that as criticism is being raised, money's being raised, and we understand that the administration says that the private interests may contribute as much as $250,000. That's a 150% increase over the maximum amount accepted during his first inauguration 4 years ago. Any reason for the increase?
Well, they're just trying to make it easier to raise the money. There's no question that people who donate large sums of money to this are people who are going to get access to the administration. That's the way politics works in Washington. That was true when Bill Clinton was sworn in twice, as well as this time. We all need to be mindful of the influence of money in politics, but I don't think there's anything all that out of the ordinary about this event.
Richard Wolff from Newsweek, step in with a thought. Were people rattled by the president's comments that the ceremony would be or could be a target for terrorists?
I don't think people were rattled that much because this has become such a familiar routine in Washington. High-profile events, high-profile targets in Washington. If you just take a look in front of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue now, the temporary barriers have become very permanent. So, it's no surprise. And remember, in 2000, before September 11th, obviously, there were huge protests. The protesters were very angry about being behind these high-wire fences. They said they were caged. It was pretty heated before. It's going to be even more so now.
Well, and in fact, speaking of protests, apparently there's one being organized that would have people turning their backs on the president's arcade during the parade, and protests are planned along the parade route. Here's a spokesperson for the anti-war group, Answer.
They're coming here from as far away as Reno, Nevada, you know, Colorado, Nebraska, and many places where we don't know. I mean, we get calls all the time from people saying, oh, I'm carpooling down from Bridgeport or wherever.
John, what do you think? Is it going to be different this time than past? I mean, there's always, a voice raised. It is America. There's always some protest. But how different do you think this is going to be?
Well, I do think the emotion that was engendered by the 2004 election, which was greater than 2004, in part because of the circumstances of the 2000 election, and in part because of the war that we're undertaking, is going to make the protest element of this, though the authorities will try to keep it at as much distance as possible, is going to be louder and probably more voluminous than we've seen in the past. We certainly saw that at the summer conventions, although there wasn't disruption as people had anticipated. I don't think that the inaugural will be disrupted, but there are a lot of people who feel awfully strongly about George Bush on both sides of the fence, and the people who don't like him are going to be heard.
Well, and there will be fences, we understand, keeping certain people away and we understand the groups like the Answer Coalition have filed a lawsuit regarding seating and public access along the parade route. Richard, tell us about that.
There's widespread concern about the extent of the closures, about access to the site. But you know what? In the end, especially in Washington, the security officials, the Secret Service, and the Metropolitan Police here, they all triumph over the protesters and their rights of access. We've seen it before at the World Bank IMF protests, and I'm sure it will happen again now. They're not going to get the access. There may even be widespread arrests and disrupt sort of preemptive strikes by the police. So I'd expect all of those things.
Well, John, briefly, we're going to talk more about what President Bush, what you feel he's going to say, what you feel he should say. But before that, more on the ceremony. Chief Justice William Rehnquist has toured the inaugural site. Apparently, he's getting ready for his fifth and perhaps final time swearing in a president. There was some thought he might not make it because of illness.
This is going to be one of the most closely watched aspects of the inaugural, oddly enough. That's rarely the case, but his health is so shaky right now, and from what we can tell, the cancer that he has is pretty grave. All of Washington is bracing for a huge fight over a Supreme Court nomination this year on both the liberal and conservative side. So everybody's going to be watching on how does he look, how frail is he when he goes up to perform this ritual, or not frail. Maybe he'll be around a little bit longer than people think.
Oddly, you know, people might be watching him more closely than the president.
You betcha.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal, also speaking to Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. You both stay put, because when we come back, we're going to find out what President Bush might say, what he should say, to heal a pretty divided nation after a very bitter election. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been previewing President Bush's second inauguration. That's coming up this Thursday at noon. You'll hear about it here on Here and Now. And we've been speaking with John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, John.
Hey.
And Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Richard.
Hello again.
And I'd like you both to take a moment and just listen to a piece of tape from Bush's first inauguration speech. It took place, of course, in January of 2001 and in a pre-9/11 world.
We will reform Social Security and Medicare, sparing our children from struggles we have the power to prevent. And we will reduce taxes to recover the momentum of our economy and reward the effort and enterprise of working Americans. We will build our defenses beyond challenge, lest weakness invite challenge. We will confront weapons of mass destruction so that a new century is spared new horrors. The enemies of liberty in our country should make no mistake. America remains engaged in the world by history and by choice, shaping a balance of power that favors freedom. We will defend our allies and our interests. We will show purpose without arrogance. We will meet aggression and bad faith with resolve and strength. And to all nations, we will speak for the values that gave our nation birth.
President Bush giving his first inauguration speech in January of 2001. And John Harwood and Richard Wolff, some say, also sending a signal to Saddam Hussein before Osama bin Laden's attack on 9/11, when he mentioned they're confronting weapons of mass destruction, which many Americans, that was a new phrase at that point.
Well, Robin, he talked in that speech about trying to make America invulnerable to challenge. He certainly got a challenge during his presidency, not the one that he expected, and it changed the course of his first 4 years in office. It took what had started to be a domestic presidency and turned it into a foreign policy one. Now he's trying to get back in the second term to some of those domestic items, Social Security in particular, that he didn't get to in the first term. Critics will quibble with whether or not, even in the foreign policy realm, he lived up to some of the promises of that speech. For example, when he said he would conduct a foreign policy without arrogance, a lot of people in European countries and some Democrats here at home say that arrogance has been a hallmark of their policy. But we'll see. This is a fresh start, and he certainly wants to try to balance the war presidency that he's declared with some legacy accomplishments in the domestic realm.
Well, Richard Wolff, you write in Newsweek that instead of scaling back his ambitions, as many other second-termers do, President Bush is going to be expanding it. But how might he telegraph that in his speech?
Well, he'll come back to Social Security, of course, and that is hugely ambitious, especially given the time frame they know they're working in, which is less than 2 years, really, effectively, before we all start talking about lame ducks. The other side of it is that overseas, his ambition has been doubled and trebled, not just about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, but Iraq and democracy now, and democracy through the region. And remember, the comments he made about weapons of mass destruction in that first inaugural weren't really about going to war or about even proliferation so much. He was trying to build support for a missile defense system, which has fallen really by the wayside. It's something that really isn't at the top of the agenda anymore. So you see how his ambitions have changed and grown, and this is very much a president who, when the chips are down, he actually tries to double his bets.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask you both how he might reach out to the nation, as is supposed to happen in a second-term speech, and especially a divided nation after a bitter election. What is President Bush going to say, John Harwood, that will both address the concerns of his critics, pull the country together a little bit, but also maybe, you know, appeal to the core, the conservative core of the Republican Party?
Well, this is a president who's extraordinarily popular with the core. There's not much more work he has to do.
Except I want to interrupt for a second. He made some comments on gay marriage in an interview in the Sunday's Washington Post. I'm sure you're aware of them, saying that not much is going to be done on a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. I'm thinking of those kinds of comments. What does he have to say on Thursday?
Well, he's going to strike a tone. Remember, the inaugural speech is a broad brush speech. He's going to strike a tone on values, and values in more than one dimension, not just in social policy as with respect to gay marriage, but on economics and the link between economics and values. That's what the ownership society is all about, and that's the rubric that he's adopting as the rubric for his domestic policy. But this is a president who has been very fixed in his goals. He hasn't been wavering in those goals, and Americans sort of like it or don't like it, and he doesn't do all that much adjustment to the polls of the moment. One thing that Richard made a point of, which I think is exactly right, is the way he has doubled his bets. Usually you see presidents pursuing very ambitious agendas with a large electoral vote behind them. Think about Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, won very big and proposed some ambitious legislation. Ronald Reagan, when he came in after his 1980 victory. This is a president who's won narrowly twice, but governed as if he is going to pursue the large goals he believes in, knowing that half the country wasn't with him.
And Richard, we only have about a minute, but I want you to comment on something that might be an example of that. Well, Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, saying at the top of our program and writing in The New Yorker that this administration already has covert military operations outside of the overview of Congress at work in Iran and other countries. It would seem to, if true, would seem to give credence to that thought that they are going ahead with what they think is a mandate.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember after the election, day after the election, when he talked to John Kerry, he talked about bringing the country together, unifying it. Oh, that talk is gone, really. That's another era for this administration. They're pressing on as if this has been a huge election victory rather than a relatively clear one. And as for overseas, I don't know that the ambition it goes beyond the sort of democratic, spreading liberty, those sorts of idealistic, soft things. The military options, you know, talking to people at the White House, are pretty limited given the scale of the challenge in Iraq.
Well, right after the second inaugural speech, there will be the State of the Union, and we hope to have you back to talk about that because that will come right after the Iraqi elections. It should be a fascinating time. I want to thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And we'll be right back. Stay there. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Around the country today, there are celebrations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and his nonviolent fight against racism. 2 years ago, with the war in Iraq looming, peace activists found special meaning in King's legacy. Producer Alan Cockle brought us their stories.
My name is Michael Knievy. I'm director of the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services. I'd like to thank all of our honored guests and friends here this evening to celebrate the City of Boston's 20th annual Martin Luther King Day celebration.
My name is Kathy Hoffman. I'm the director of the Cambridge Peace Commission. On Martin Luther King Day, we have people gathering in front of Cambridge City Hall with placards which read, "Stand for Peace in the Spirit of Martin."
Ladies and gentlemen,
we have leaders from our community reading excerpts of Martin Luther King's 1967 speech at Riverside Church, in which he not only comes out against the war in Vietnam, but really unpacks some of the connections between war-making and the costs here at home.
Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war.
He talks about working with young people in urban areas in the United States who say to him, "Martin, why should we renounce violence?"
Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Estefania Alves is a student at Jeremiah Burke High School in Dorchester.
Good evening, everyone. At the age of 17, I have witnessed my 3-year-old cousin die to violence and also lost a 21-year-old cousin last month to violence.
Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America.
Dr. Martin Luther King remains one of the most prominent figures in history today because of his tremendous efforts in making a change. He was a man who fought for his people, so dedicated. He put his life on the line for his people.
I think he'd be heartsick.
My name is Chuck Turner. I'm a city councilor in the city of Boston. While many of the more blatant forms of segregation and discrimination have been eliminated, I think you'd be concerned about the government moving away from funding for public housing to see our schools in shambles across the country. And I think he'd be most concerned about the fact that 50% of every disposable dollar that the U.S. has is going into the military war machine.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values.
Dr. King's commitment to make a better world is what inspired me to keep striving. When my cousin passed away last January, while everyone was mourning, I was out working with the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, organizing a vigil and outreaching to people in my community.
We will but make the right choice. We will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
NBC News Hotline Special Report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
What inspires me is the combination of his vision and joining that to a movement.
His message is we all are struck in the image of God. We all have that divine spirit in us. And so Dr. King showed us not just his greatness, but revealed to us what each and every one of us could do if we chose to take up the cross.
If Dr. King made a difference, I know I can too.
Our piece on peace activists in Boston was produced by Alan Cockle. The march to Super Bowl 39 continues. After this weekend's contest, the Philadelphia Eagles, or Eagles as they are called, will meet the Atlanta Falcons for the NFC Championship, while the Pittsburgh Steelers host the New England Patriots for the AFC title. And for a quick recap, we turn to Chicago Sun-Times sports columnist Ron Rappaport. Ron, we must start with the AFC, where the hometown Patriots spanked the Indianapolis Colts 20-3 to the surprise of those who thought Colts quarterback Peyton Manning, you know, was going to have a field day.
Yeah, I was one of those who did. I thought that Manning might just dominate because he's been playing so incredibly well, not only all season, Robin, but particularly in the playoffs. But having said that, you couldn't overlook the Patriots, so you can't be surprised that they won. What did surprise me was how intimidated Manning and the Colts looked.
They seemed nervous. They seemed nervous.
Almost from the minute they got on the field.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it was the weather or just the Colts' defense or the fact that they couldn't really capitalize on some early opportunities. But, boy, it just didn't look like the same Peyton Manning we've been watching all season.
What a day to have an off day for him. But on the Patriots go to meet Pittsburgh. Now, Pittsburgh needed an overtime field goal to overcome the Jets on Saturday. Now they go on to play the Pats. They beat the Patriots in their last meeting. So what do you think? Does this mean trouble?
Well, I think the Patriots are definitely going to be favored. Ben Roethlisberger did not look good against the Jets. And they were very, very lucky to win that game. The Jets missed two easily makeable field goals towards the end. I think the Patriots will be favored even though the game is in Pittsburgh. I really think that anybody would be foolish to bet against the Patriots now. And Roethlisberger and the Steelers are really going to have to step up their game. Otherwise, I think we might be looking at a clean sweep for Boston this year, Robin.
Well, that's what we're thinking here in Boston, but we'll see what happens there. Over to the NFC, the Philadelphia Eagles, the Eagles, have lost three straight conference championships. They're hosting the Atlanta Falcons this weekend. We understand the angst level in Philly is off the charts. You know, they haven't reached a Super Bowl in 24 years.
Well, there's only one question about the Eagles. There's no question that offensively they're still a really good team. They took it to Minnesota, no problem at all. The only question that Eagles fans have to worry about is whether they can contain Michael Vick, the unbelievably great quarterback, versatile quarterback for the Falcons. If they can keep him in check, they win the game. If not, anything can happen. Mm. That's the big problem that faces the Eagles this weekend.
Well, we have less than a week to put together our little snacks and whatnot for the big game this weekend, but what are your predictions for the very big game, Super Bowl? Who's it going to be?
Well, I think it may very well be the Eagles and the Patriots. I'm not going to go against form this late in the game, Rob.
Well, you know where our heart lies. Chicago Sun-Times and NPR sports commentator Ron Rappaport. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be with you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, has launched a public relations campaign to counteract what it says are false allegations and urban legends that have been promoted by special interest groups opposed to the company. The initiative is a first in Walmart's 43-year history. Financial reporter Mark Mills joins us now to talk about the Walmart counteroffensive. Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we have said on this program, this has been a company under fire for some time for labor practices, for the perception that they put small businesses and communities out of business. Why are they launching this campaign now?
CEO Lee Scott said that it's the preponderance of false statements about the company that prompted their action at this time. He said employees are tired of all this criticism and that the company, quote, decided it was time to draw our own line in the sand. And so they did that by launching this campaign late last week with full-page ads in 100 newspapers, including USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. And they've put a new website together called WalmartFacts.com to get out their story. And CEO Scott made himself available for a number of interviews with the press.
In fact, CEO Lee Scott was interviewed by CNBC late last week. Here's a portion.
Today's announcement, in some ways, kind of makes the springboard for a thrust of being aggressive in telling this story about the quality of jobs we have, the quality of company that we have. We save Americans $20 billion a year in the purchase of goods that causes their life to be better.
The message seems to be, Mark Mills, that Walmart is good for America. It makes life better.
Well, the company certainly believes that, not only for all those consumers, but I think very significantly here they're saying they treat their workers a lot better than is generally perceived by most of the world from all the comments you hear.
Well, and in fact, as I said, I'm on the website, which is WalmartFacts.com. I've gone to the area of benefits, for instance. Now, Walmart has been attacked for, in some cases, reports of encouraging their workers to go and get state and local aid to make up for the benefits that they don't get for the company. And some have felt that that's very unfair, taking aid out of the community to people who have jobs. I'm at the section on benefits. Fact, Walmart offers affordable health care benefits to our associates, and it goes on and on and on. They do seem to be providing specifics.
They are providing a lot of specifics. For example, they say the average wage for a full-time hourly associate is almost twice the federal minimum wage, so it's over $10 an hour. And on health care, they say that a family plan through Walmart costs as little as $155 a month for a full-time employee. So I think those are the kind of numbers that really belie a lot of what the general impression is. That's when they get to this urban myth or urban legend thing they're talking about.
Well, at least from their point of view, because as you all know, Walmart is currently the target of a class action lawsuit representing 1.6 million women who are current or former employees. The suit claims women have been systematically underpaid and underpromoted by Walmart. Are they directly addressing that issue?
Not in their advertising, not in what they've put out. Certainly CEO Scott was asked about it in some of the interviews that he did, and he frankly said he did not expect any particular favorable reaction from those pursuing lawsuits against the company. But one of the facts they did put out in their information was that Walmart said that 40% of store management positions are held by women.
Yeah. Was the company specific about the special interests that Walmart claims are spreading this false, you know, what they say is false information?
They didn't name names, but, you know, aside from that women's legal action, there's another lawsuit alleging that Walmart managers deleted hours from workers' payroll records and didn't provide all the meal and rest breaks that were required. There is a union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, that claims Walmart puts a downward pressure on wages and benefits and that it drives jobs to China. CEO Scott did make one interesting comment, I thought, though. He said that many of the critics are people whose lifestyle doesn't change when the price of fuel changes. In other words, affluent people who probably don't shop at Walmart.
And one last question, Mark Mills. Have the critics of Walmart had the time to go through the information on the website and either question it or confirm it?
The union that I mentioned did say that they felt that Walmart's statement did not coincide with the facts, that they feel that the company still does put downward pressure on wages and prices, and that they're not accepting the company's statements as being all that accurate or all that fair representation of Walmart's position in the country.
Well, if you want to see for yourself, go to our website. We'll link to it there. And in the meantime, Mark Mills, business reporter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. In 1910, 15 long trains filled with white boxing fans traveled to Reno, Nevada to see the prize fight of the century between the so-called Great White Hope, Jim Jeffries, and Jack Johnson, who 2 years earlier shocked and infuriated whites by becoming the first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world.
The press reacted as if Armageddon was here. That this may be the moment when it all starts to fall apart for white society.
Jack Johnson was larger than life, and even in the Jim Crow South, he wasn't afraid to show it. Many whites at the time saw beating Jack Johnson as righting a social wrong. His contemporary, W.E.B. Du Bois, said that Johnson's unforgivable blackness was the source of his troubles. And Unforgivable Blackness is the title of the new Ken Burns two-part documentary about boxer Jack Johnson. It airs tonight and tomorrow on PBS stations around the country. And Ken joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And in your new film, writer Stanley Crouch calls Johnson a pure individual. James Earl Jones calls his story a story of hubris, not race. He was, if a hero to many, a complicated hero.
It is. You know, we're all our own worst enemy, and Jack Johnson, very much so. But at the same time, he represents, as Stanley Crouch suggests, this person for whom there's no recipe, this homemade guy, he puts it, that something in the air and the water and the, most important, the history of America is able to produce somebody who, in this instance, a black kid from Galveston, Texas, born in 1878, sees no reason why he can't live his life nothing short of a free man. And the story that is set in motion from this, to us, rather innocent impulse is one of the most dramatic I've ever come across. This was a man who holds three patents with the United States government for wrenches that he designed to adjust the fast cars he loved to drive. This is a man who understood the modern media world. He's the only historical character I've ever come in contact with who would be perfectly at home today.
We understand there were pictures of him that you found. He had this incredible gaze. He towered over people. You describe more about his physicality.
He's a beautiful, beautiful human specimen. He seems utterly modern. You know, I said to somebody the other day that it was almost like he was photoshopped into these old photographs of the first two decades of the 20th century, that everyone else in their bowlers and their stiff collars look sort of appropriate. And Jack Johnson could survive here. He's cool. He's the first kind of hip-hop guy. You know, he's got his bling and his entourage and his fast cars and his long coats and his winning smile. And
we know who won the fight that was this called the fight of the century that lent itself to that phrase, the Great White Hope. And by the way, tell us.
There was an unwritten rule that blacks couldn't fight for the ultimate heavyweight title. So blacks could fight for the lesser titles, and then they sort of had a traffic jam. They sort of bunched up, and only one, Jack, they fought each other lots of times. Jack Johnson said no, and he kept knocking at the door, knocking at the door. And champions, Jim Jeffries, the most fearsome of all, retired undefeated rather than fight a Negro, as he put it. You can imagine what he really said. But of course, course, the unspoken thing isn't that nobody could risk being beaten by a black man in this age of the white man's burden, of the imperialism over the darker races of mankind, as the paper said, and the racism is just rampant. So Jeffries retires undefeated. A later champion, lesser champion, accepts enough money. Somebody offers him enough money. He fights Johnson. Johnson demolishes him. And then this cry comes out, first voiced by the novelist Jack London, a socialist whose sympathies did not extend to people of color, that we had to find a white hope to wipe the golden smile off Jack Johnson's face. He had a gold implant. And they couldn't do it. Every comer he would take care of. So finally, Jeffries was persuaded to unretire, to go into training, which he did, and to meet Jack Johnson on July 4th in 1910 in Reno, Nevada for the Battle of the Century, and that it was clear that Jim Jeffries was the great white hope, the man who would restore to its rightful race the boxing supremacy. Johnson demolished him, and there were race riots in which many, many people were dead, hundreds injured in cities north and south around the country, white-on-black violence, the likes we had not seen and would not see until the assassination of Martin Luther King, all in response to a black man winning the title again. Now he's the undisputed champion, and when our country couldn't beat him in the ring, they went after him for his sex life.
And we should say they used laws intended to stop white sex slavery to attack Jack Johnson because these laws prohibited traveling with prostitutes across state lines, and he married white prostitutes and traveled with them.
This is the thing. You know, our country is simultaneously Puritan and purient, and we vibrate very strangely when it comes to sex. And when that sex is between a black man and a white woman, look, you think of the echoes today.
Yeah. Well, he fled the country after being tried and convicted, eventually came back, served his time. And then, you know, I'd said he won that big boxing match. But did he ultimately lose? Did society ultimately beat him down?
He realizes the chances of appeal are slim. He goes to Canada, he escapes to Canada and then to Europe for several years. While he's in exile, this First World War starts. People have moved away from him. There aren't that many boxing opportunities. And he finally is persuaded to come back to Havana, Cuba, and fight. He's 38. He's out of shape, beyond the point when most boxers are in their prime. And he's going to fight a young guy in 105-degree heat for 26 rounds, and he finally goes down. They immediately take the title away from him. An African-American won't hold the title for another 22 years, and that African-American, Joe Louis, is the anti-Jack Johnson, passive and friendly and you know, light-skinned and not going out with white women and not being photographed in saloons, and Jack Johnson owned a saloon. So he was denied his livelihood from the moment he was convicted and had this. He thought that if he fought this fight in Havana, it would be the quid pro quo. He'd be able to come back into the country. And the Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, said no. Mm-hmm. So that's it. He's out. And he comes back finally, serves his term in Leavenworth, always his own man, and then lives out his very dignified life on the fringes of the boxing world he loved, on the fringes of the spotlight he craved so much, and lives till 67 into the mid-40s.
What do you want people to take away from this? What do you want them to think about Jack Johnson?
Well, first of all, race is the central sub-theme of American life. And Jack Johnson is such a compelling figure that his bravery alone, he could have been killed at any fight. His bravery alone is just worth the price of admission, I think, let alone his humor, his good looks, all of the plot-driven tragedies and successes and these monumental fights that you can't believe that there's film footage, and we have hours of film footage, and new digital technology allows us to go in and really see when we hear in the newspapers that he would pound at his chest and say hit here to his opponent or laugh at the corner men who are spewing racial invective at him. We could see that now. We've gone in digitally, and there is this big grinning Jack Johnson in the middle of 1908, in 1910, and suddenly the distance of the decades dissolves, and you're there. And of course, in the end, for storytellers, that's all you want, is to feel like you're there.
Ken Burns, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And by the way, tomorrow, how Miles Davis and Wynton Marsalis immortalized Jack Johnson. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.